last investigator I met with was Dr. Irene Gobriel, and to begin, she presented a patient from her practice.
This is one of the cases that we usually see. A 68-year-old patient comes in, had some GI problems, had some fatigue, cytopenias, and that led to further workup. And during the workup, she had an actual monoclonal protein that was detected, and it showed that she had an M spike. That led to actual workup, including a bone marrow biopsy, and she had 70% involvement of plasma cells. Now, these days with multiple myeloma, you want to know what kind of cytogenetics and FISH that she had. And this is important because, of course, it helps with the prognosis and hopefully in the future precision medicine for those patients. So she had a 1Q amplification, a 14-16 translocation, and these are usually worse prognosis for those patients. Now, she didn't have lytic lesions. She did have anemia, as we know, but again, she was started on bortezomib, lenalidomide, and dexamethasone. And that was the induction regimen that we used. And the question is always, what are we using these days for upfront therapy? So three-drug regimen is the standard currently, although we can talk about definitely four-drug regimens that are going to happen very soon. And then, of course, stem cell transplant and followed by maintenance therapy. Now, the patient had lenalidomide maintenance therapy, and she was on 5 milligrams. And then slowly her light chains started to increase, and we saw that she's starting to have progression. And she was switched to a second line of therapy with daratumumab, which is the CD38 monoclonal antibody, with pomalidomide and dexamethasone. And so far, she's had an excellent response to this regimen.
So I'd like to kind of go back through the case and pick out a few points. First, in terms of selection of upfront therapy, can you talk about where we are today? And of course, you referred to the impending four-drug regimens. Can you kind of overview where we are right now in terms of induction therapy in the younger patient?
Yeah, absolutely. So in a younger patient, currently what we're doing is three-drug regimens that are giving us an excellent response. And these could be RVD, which is lenalidomide, bortezomib, and dexamethasone, or in some cases, KRD, which is carfilzomib, lenalidomide, and dexamethasone. And you can think about it followed by potentially stem cell transplant. And I'm saying potentially because there is a big debate whether we should transplant everyone or not who's young or transplant eligible, and followed by maintenance therapy. Now, that may change very soon because four-drug regimen is starting to show in multiple clinical trials, whether in the elderly or even in the young patients, giving us the addition of a monoclonal antibody. Now we're using daratumumab as our monoclonal antibody to be added to the three-drug regimen. So we know that daratumumab with melphalan and prednisone has been shown already in the elderly population. We know that daratumumab with lenalidomide and dexamethasone also in the elderly population, which was the MAIA study. Now we're starting to see upfront regimens, which are the Cassiopeia study, and then we're waiting hopefully for the daratumumab, bortezomib, lenalidomide, and dexamethasone regimen to be presented, and that likely will become the standard for us.
And you mentioned the Cassiopeia study. Could you talk about specifically what they looked at and what they saw there?
So the Cassiopeia study was important because for the first time we're trying to ask the question in an upfront patient using the standard of care that we use, bortezomib, thalidomide, and dexamethasone. So in European studies, we're not using lenalidomide, but thalidomide in some patients, with and without daratumumab, whether you would have an improvement in response and progression-free survival. And the answer was yes for both. An excellent depth of response, MRD negative disease much higher, and then a longer remission in those patients. And we're starting to see that indeed this combination gives you not just the depth of response, but potentially very long remissions that are reflective of MRD negative disease giving you a longer remission in your patients.
You mentioned the regimen with lenalidomide, dexamethasone, and daratumumab. Are you utilizing that right now, and in what situations?
It's a great question. In the elderly population, which was the MAIA study, so the MAIA study was Lendex, which was based on the original French study by Thierry Facon, MPT versus Lendex, and that showed that Lendex was much better. This then was followed Dara-Lendex versus Lendex in an elderly population. Can you use daratumumab? And that was the MAIA, and indeed showed, again, an amazing response rate, MRD negative disease. The question is, here in the United States, we've been using RVD light or three-drug combination at a lower dose. So lenalidomide, bortezomib, dexamethasone at a much lower dose. And the question is, should we switch and go to Dara-Lendex, or should we stick to RVD light in our patients? Or are we going to do all of them, four drug regimen in a healthy older patient, but still fit and capable of taking four drugs. So we don't know yet how we're switching our practice, but in general, if I cannot give someone bortezomib, I would definitely think of a Daralendex in those patients.
You mentioned the controversial issue about transplant, and I'm curious how you approach it to patients and how you vary the way you approach it based on what their status is, what their risk is, and whether you include MRD as part of that decision.
It's a great question. So for many years, we said that transplant indeed improves overall survival in our patients, and that's why we were giving transplant. And then the IFM-DFCI studies were designed, and the IFM study was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, showing us indeed you get a progression-free survival, but you don't get an overall survival benefit from transplant. And the biggest benefit that you see in those patients is the ones who get into MRD. However, if you look around it the other way and ask, for patients who achieved MRD and did not need the transplant, did they also get the same benefit? And you start asking your question, well, if I can achieve MRD anyways without transplant, do I need it or not? So we're starting to ask the question, if I achieve MRD, transplant or no transplant, I'll get probably the same survival. And the Forte study was asking that same question. That was the KRD transplant or KRD 12 cycles. And in that one, again, depth of response was very similar. MRD negative was very similar. So there is a big debate whether indeed transplant will give you that benefit for long term, or all you're doing is indeed improving MRD, which it does improve the MRD. And if your upfront regimen is good enough and you get MRD, maybe you don't need transplant.
What is the likelihood of attaining MRD with RVD and KRD?
So KRD definitely gives us a deeper response early on, and most of those patients, about 60% or so, will get MRD negative disease. RVD, the numbers of MRD negative is slightly lower than that, but we don't know what their RVD will show us. And in that case, would it be easier? Again, there is some toxicity with carfilzomib. There is different toxicity with bortezomib. So maybe their RVD can give us that same depth of response that you see with a KRD regimen in other patients.
Do you think it's rational to be using MRD right now outside a clinical trial setting?
I absolutely think that it's going to happen. We are discussing right now with the FDA that this is one of the endpoints. It does correlate very well with progression-free survival. The hope is that it also correlates with overall survival in our patients. And it's a surrogate marker of how well your response was. I mean, in the older days, which is what we do right now, complete remission is the correlative work that you do for improving progression-free survival. This is a better complete remission. This is even deeper remission for those patients.
I guess I want to ask specifically in the question of delayed or immediate transplant, do you think that it is rational outside a trial setting for a community-based oncologist to get an MRD and consider it as a factor?
I don't think we're there yet for the practice. I think it's still an academic question because we're still having the studies designed, MRD positive or negative, what do? You randomize them. How long the MRD should be? Should you wait 1 year for an MRD negative disease? So there are still a lot of questions, but I think it's getting there, and at least we should be ordering it. And then whether you act on it or not in the community is a different question.
Getting back to your patient, one thing that you didn't comment on but was in your write-up that I was kind of curious about was that she seemed to be losing blood in her bowel. She had a positive fecal. Did you ever find the source for that?
Yeah, so at that point, the biggest problem that we had is we were wondering whether she has amyloidosis or not. But at that time, I think she didn't have any positive amyloid studies. The colonoscopy was actually negative. And afterwards, there were no further blood loss. So there was no specific etiology, but she didn't have it anymore.
Interesting. So getting back to this case, another time point was the maintenance therapy she got, specifically the lenalidomide. Can you talk about the situations where you use maintenance? Are there any situations after transplant when you don't use maintenance? For example, patients in complete remission, or let's say even MRD negative. And also the question of, do you ever add anything to lenalidomide?
Yeah, great question. So len has been the maintenance therapy that we use for everyone. However, should you really use it forever or should you stop therapy? And I think the MRD question will come in play a lot in the maintenance therapy. Most of the trials that are being designed right now are actually asking the question, after you've been MRD negative for about a year, should you stop maintenance therapy or not? So they're randomizing them. So the answer of how long to maintain therapy of maintenance is going to happen in the future, but we don't have it right now. Should you maintain everyone? The answer is yes. Everyone needs maintenance for now. It's just the duration. What do you use for maintenance is another great question. We have lenalidomide that has been the standard. We have questions on ixazomib or bortezomib. We had lenalidomide-bortezomib combinations that we've been using for high-risk population. We use sub-Q every 2 weeks, but you can think of ixazomib as an alternative option. And then you have daratumumab as a third alternative option. And I think it's good to have those options because there are patients who are on len who would not do very well because of fatigue or diarrhea. And instead of having nothing for them, you can think of the alternative options for them.
Did you say dara as maintenance?
Dara as maintenance is being studied, yes.
But would you use it outside a trial setting right now?
Not right now.
So what is your experience using lenalidomide long-term in the maintenance setting? What are some of the tolerability issues that you run into and how do you deal with them?
Yeah, so I think that most of our patients tolerate very well lenalidomide, and you can always lower the dose. I think the biggest questions we have are the fatigue, the cytopenias, and the diarrhea that we see, as well as infection risk. The other thing that we are underestimating, but now we're starting to understand it better, is those patients who have a CHIP mutation, which is a stem cell mutation, and whether that is part of the problems of secondary MDSs and leukemias and cancers. And we're starting to study now whether that CHIP mutation is really correlating with some of those markers. It's still to be done in the future, but these are markers potentially for whether patients will tolerate it or not.
What kind of mutation? CHIP mutation?
So CHIP, which is clonal hematopoiesis of indeterminate potential, these are the leukemia mutations, so DNMT3, TET2, all of those well-known leukemia mutations, you can detect them in a normal stem cell, or not normal, but in aging stem cells, and we're starting to see that as sort of the MGUS of leukemia in a way.
Wow, interesting. Is that an assay you can do now clinically, or is it being developed?
We have it actually available at Dana-Farber clinically. It's a CLIA-approved test that we order in our patients, and the hope is that that will be available for many others.
And do you ever see that in patients? And if you do, how often do you see it, and what do you do?
So it increases with age. It's exactly like MGUS. As we get older, it increases. You can get up to 7% in patients over the age of 50. We think that it's much higher in cases of lymphoma and myeloma. Not that we think, but we actually did the study. So we showed recently that 30% of patients with myeloma may have CHIP mutations, which is much higher than the normal age-matched control population. And the question is, will that affect transplant? Will that affect lenalidomide maintenance long-term? So we're still working on those questions, but it's important to potentially start asking this, not only because it can increase leukemia, but it also increases cardiovascular death. So patients who had CHIP mutations actually died much faster because of cardiovascular death, not because only of leukemias and lymphomas.
Cardiovascular deaths, what's the pathophysiology there?
So the CHIP mutations in the macrophages, because these are stem cells, will then actually be part of that thromboembolic status and the plaques that you have in the coronary arteries. And that leads to actually heart attacks in those patients.
Wow.
So it was in the New England Journal of Medicine paper originally, and then the etiology was further clarified in mouse models.
So if you see that mutation, the CHIP mutation, do you pull away from using lenalidomide, for example?
So it's a great question. In our study, and again, it was 600 patients only, and it's not published yet, but it was an abstract in American Society of Hematology last year, we found that actually having maintenance with lenalidomide abrogates the worst survival that you have in those patients with CHIP mutations. So it was different than what we expected. You expect that actually it will be worse, but it was actually improving. But there is more work to be done because certain mutations may actually get worse, like P53 mutations.
That's really interesting. So moving on to the point at which this patient had relapse and you used darapom, can you talk a little bit about this very common scenario of a patient who relapses on len maintenance after transplant, what all the evidence-based options are, how do you sort through them, and how did you come up with darapom for this lady?
Yeah, so first relapse is very important for us, again, because we still want to achieve that depth of response even in the first relapse. And we've shown that MRD negative disease, even in the first relapse, is important for progression-free survival. And then you start asking, well, which regimen should you use? So you have multiple three-drug combinations again. You have the daratumumab bortezomib dex, the daratumumab len dex, which were the original Castor study, and then you have the DARA-POMDEX, which was a phase 2 study, not a phase 3 study. And then you have, of course, the KRD, carfilzomib-lendex, ixazomib-lendex, and you have elotuzumab-lendex. You have so many different combinations, and you start asking yourself, which one should I use? I think most of us now are very comfortable to use daratumumab in the first relapse. However, when we start using it in the upfront setting, you'll change that. You will not be using it in that first relapse because you've already pushed it upfront. KRD comes in play very nicely in many patients who have not had carfilzomib already. But again, you have to be careful with cardiac toxicity potentially in those patients. And then, of course, the question of elotuzumab and if there is a specific subgroup of patients who may benefit from elo, the ones who have a very small light chain increase, the ones who are progressing very slowly and may have a benefit from immune response.
What's the advantage, though, of using elo in a patient like that compared to, say, Dara?
It's hard to know because there is no comparison head-to-head in any clinical trial. We are very comfortable in the first relapse with daratumumab, but potentially there is benefit for some patients of using ixa or elo in some of them, or KRD, of course.
I saw a paper that you did looking at immunotherapy. I think there was kind of a group that got together, and you wrote a really great paper about it. One of the things I liked about it was some of the mechanism stuff that you had in there. Can you talk a little bit about your vision of how ELO works and how Dara works for starters?
Yeah. So again, ELO works mainly as an NK cell activator. It's a SLAMF7 antibody or inhibitor of SLAMF7, but mainly its function is in immune regulation through the NK system. And I think we need to still understand more that mechanism and how specific patients may benefit from it versus others. There are, again, multiple methods of working. It could be direct effect on the tumor cells, but it also be activation of immune cells, specifically T cells or subsets of T cells. Now, there are so many other things. The checkpoint inhibitors, as you know, have been a problem for us in multiple myeloma, but maybe subgroups of patients may benefit from other immunotherapies or immune checkpoint inhibitors other than PD-1 and PD-L1, or testing them without the lenalidomide because the worst survival and the death happened in the patients who had the combination with lenalidomide. So there is still a resurgence of thinking of immune checkpoint inhibitors coming along. And of course, cellular therapy, CAR-T, is very important. And then all the BCMA antibodies are coming along. So that's the bispecifics. You can think the BCMA antibody also works by immune cell regulation. So there is this whole area that's starting to explode for us now as immunotherapy in myeloma.
Could you talk a little bit about the data that is out there in terms of checkpoint inhibitors in myeloma?
So there were two large studies. There were first phase 2 studies of Pembro in multiple myeloma, which showed us that Pembro-Lendex was very effective and high responses in patients with myeloma. That led to phase 3 studies, one upfront, one relapsed. The problem with both of them is that there was no difference in response in the cohorts of Pembro-Lendex versus Lendex. And there was a worse survival, increased death in both of those cohorts. So, of course, the FDA stopped the trials and said, we do not continue anymore and let's try to understand what happened in those patients. We still don't know whether that was related to the combination of Pembro with Len, whether this affects it when you use PD-1 inhibitors with other agents, and what is the mechanism, or is there a subgroup of patients who would benefit and others who would be harmed from it. So there is definitely more work and more analysis in that, but we're still trying to see, are there other immune checkpoint inhibitors that could be used in myeloma that are not the same ones like the PD-1, PD-L1?
You mentioned CAR-T therapy. Again, could you kind of go through how that's been developed and where things are with that right now?
Yeah, so amazing work, mainly on the BCMA CAR-T. So, of course, there has been the CD19, the first few cases. We don't really use CD19 CAR-T in myeloma that much, but it was the first publication. Then the BCMA CAR-Ts really are taking over. There is development for other ones like SLAMF7 and CD38 or 138, but again, these are not as well developed. The CAR-Ts of BCMA, the main one, of course, is the BB2121. And this is, again, very well developed. We're hoping that we will get approval in the next year or so. And the question is that really a curative intent for some patients? So a year ago, we were all excited saying, this is it, they're responding. You would see people with amazing responses immediately after having the worst disease ever and 7 lines or 10 lines of therapy, and their PET scans are lighting up like a Christmas tree. Now, unfortunately, we're starting to see the progressions and the relapses of those patients. So it's about an 80% response rate, MRD negative, very high in those patients, but about a 1-year response and then progression afterwards. Hard to know why. Are you using using your immune cell activation? Do you need something else combined with the CAR T? Are we using the right population, or are we waiting too long and too late for those patients? So there are so many new methods. There is better development methods for the CAR Ts, and there is also better ways of saying, let's use it upfront. Let's use it in the high-risk cytogenetic patients, but earlier, and not wait for them to be really heavily pretreated.
Of course, a big issue with CAR T is toxicity, cytokine release, neurologic toxicity has been seen with lymphomas, for example. What's been seen with this BCMA kind of a preparation?
Yeah, same thing again, the cytokine release syndrome, the confusions, and as well as sepsis in some patients. And again, the cytokine release syndrome, if you use the IL-6 antibody, then most of those patients respond well. The CNS confusions and other problems, we have seen less of that. And I think, again, if the tumor burden is too high, your risk of a cytokine release syndrome is much higher compared to the patients with less tumor burden. And some of the new studies that we're designing now are asking the question, do you wait until you have a good remission in some patients and then start adding the CAR T therapy as a way to maintain those patients?
So right now, given the caveats that are starting to come in with people developing progressive disease, at what point should a patient be referred for consideration of CAR T, maybe a trial? And at what point should the patient be referred for practical considerations that it really would be that participation in a trial would be critical to their outcome?
Yeah. So again, it's not only CAR Ts, but bispecifics are going to come along. So I would put them both in consideration. And I would say any very young patient, anyone with very high risk cytogenetics, is very essential to think early on, the regular therapy that we use for myeloma right now will not work. Am I going to maintain this patient with CAR T or with a bispecific after I give them that induction? First relapse, again, if they are high risk cytogenetics, if they have a P53-17P mutation, the first thing I'm thinking is immunotherapy for those patients and not trying to wait for the third and fourth line of therapy for those.
You had a patient here who got BCMA CAR T. What happened there?
Yeah. So I think he was in his 50s. He actually had multiple lines of therapy, if I remember correctly, at least 8. And he actually had the BCMA conjugated antibody and had a great response to it for a while and then relapsed, had further therapy later on, and then now recently received the CAR T.
Before you go on, you said BCMA antibody?
Yes, this is the one that's a BCMA conjugated with a toxin, and basically it works by inducing apoptosis in those cells, but it also can activate the immune system.
So, but there was a trial, there was an agent, which was just the antibody, and what, that didn't work?
It's not a naked antibody, so it's a conjugated antibody. And it works very well. In fact, it received FDA approval that they can go on with their phase 3 trials, and we have it as compassionate use in some patients. So it's actually a very good drug that works right now.
So essentially, an antibody drug conjugate?
Yes.
Antibody drug conjugate to BCMA. Interesting.
Yeah. I can't remember all the numbers. Huh. And they just named it now Bella or Bella something. It's a Bella name, but it's a very long name.
And so how long ago did this man get the CAR T treatment?
He just received it 4 months ago.
And how did he tolerate it?
He did very well, actually. He had no problems, was discharged from the hospital. Again, some fatigue, but no cytokine release and no problems.
Is there a correlation between cytokine release and treatment benefit? Do you feel a little concerned when you see people not having cytokine release?
I don't know that there is a correlation with cytokine release and benefit. I think that there is a correlation with tumor burden and cytokine release, but I think we have to wait and see long-term responses in many of those patients.
And at this point, is this man responding?
He's responding beautifully.
That's great. One other thing about his history that I thought was interesting, that earlier on, I guess it was maybe 10 years ago, that he developed psychosis requiring a psychiatric admission because of dexamethasone. How often have you seen that? What happened?
Yeah, very rarely. But this patient, it was very hard to come up with regimens for him because we cannot give him dex. And all of our regimens have dexamethasone in them. Very few of them don't. So it was a discussion every single time, how can we give that regimen without dexamethasone?
And he had no psychiatric history, or it was just this idiosyncratic thing?
Yeah, and then was really psychotic after receiving high-dose dexamethasone.
Wow, that is really interesting. Let's talk a little bit about smoldering myeloma. And you have a 40-year-old woman with 3 children. I guess she presented in 2015. Can you talk about her?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, one of the biggest hot topics now in myeloma is, are we going to treat early? So smoldering myeloma is becoming the topic, and especially with the new data that was shown in ASCO with the lenalidomide treatment and high-risk smoldering versus observation. So again, this is a young woman, three young kids, goes to her doctor, and during a workup, they find that she has a small monoclonal protein, comes to us for a second opinion. And again, during the workup, she does not have end organ damage of myeloma. So she doesn't have the CRAB criteria or the new slim CRAB, which is the myeloma defining events. And with discussions with her, she had high risk numbers. So she had a, and again, it depends what you call high risk smoldering myeloma now, because there is the Mayo criteria, there is the new Mayo criteria, which is 20%, 2 grams, and 20 as the light chain ratio. So this is changing the way we think, but then there's also the Spanish criteria. But at any event, using one of those methods, she had a high risk smoldering myeloma, which gives you the risk of progression 50% in 2 years. So here's a young woman, likely she will have end organ damage in 2 years. And you start asking the question, do we wait for you to have fractures and anemia and renal failure, or should we treat you early? And this is not just a philosophical question these days, but it's an important question for people to say, what are we waiting for? Why are we watching those patients until they have failure, basically, and falling apart, and then we treat them? However, what do you treat them with is a very important question. So if you look at the Spanish study, and that was done a few years ago, Len-Dex versus observation, those patients had indeed an improvement of progression-free survival and overall survival. But for many reasons, we said we will not apply this as a standard of care because many of those patients may have had real myeloma and they were not captured correctly. Then ECOG came along, and that was just presented in ASCO, and that was Len alone versus observation, and again showed the progression-free survival, but there was no overall survival benefit shown yet. That opens another big question because it has a few caveats in it. One, they were not all high risk. There was actually inclusion of low risk and intermediate risk patients. And two, you're giving Len alone until progression. So those patients received lenalidomide for years and years and years and not just 2 years and then you stop. So are you causing selection of certain clones? Are you causing drug resistance? Do you cause fatigue? 50% of the patients could not stay on therapy. So although it's an amazing thing because now we have two large randomized studies that show there is benefit from early intervention, you still have a lot of questions unanswered, which is which regimen to use. Should we use one drug alone or should we go all the way to KRD transplant, which is the Spanish are doing KRD transplant, or there a KRD, which Mayo Clinic is doing, to just use one drug like lenalidomide. So there is a big debate in the myeloma world now of what are the regimens to use. We have Elo-Lendex, Ixazomib-Lendex, as well as many other clinical trials with daratumumab ongoing. And there was a registration study of Dara versus observation that was done, and we're hoping to wait for the data for it, this one.
So can you bring us up to date on this lady?
Yeah, absolutely. So she received the Elo-Lendex phase 2 trial that we had at Dana-Farber. She had an excellent response. However, 2 years after stopping therapy, her numbers came up and they were increasing. And every time I see her, her light chains and M-spike increase. Remember, she has a 17p deletion. So she has one of the worst prognostic features we have. And again, started to progress. And as a worried person, of course, it was a discussion of how to treat her. Now, her numbers went on to the point that she was almost myeloma with end organ damage. So we went on and she received KRD, she went on to receive transplant and then maintenance therapy, and she's actually in a great remission right now.
And she's on, you said KR maintenance?
And she got KR maintenance and not just lenalidomide maintenance, which was one of the trials. So we were mimicking a trial, but it was one of the trials that was going on at that time of KR maintenance.
So how long does that continue, the maintenance?
So it was only a 1 year maintenance that we gave her with the carfilzomib, and you give it only once a month, and then we stopped and we just continued with the lenalidomide.
We were talking before about carfilzomib in terms of upfront therapy in general, and I think you referred to some of the toxic issues that have been seen there. I've always been curious about the dyspnea and question mark cardiorespiratory issues that occur with carfilzomib. What have we learned about that?
Yeah, it's hard to know exactly the mechanism. Some people think it's a vasoconstriction. Some people think it was all the volume that we give them because we give them a lot of fluids. So one of the ideas that we have is really being careful that their blood pressure is well controlled early on and we're not giving that many fluids as we used to give. But now I think as we understand better how to use carfilzomib, and in fact, many of us are using now the one day only, not the 2 days in a row, and we're using the higher dose, not the one that's the lower dose, we're seeing amazing responses and many of the toxicities that we've observed are easier to take care of. I'm not decreasing the chance. There is definitely that cardiac toxicity and heart failure that has been seen in some patients, but that's a much smaller number of patients that have this significant side effect.
Let's talk about other new agents in development. And I had the pleasure of working with your colleague, Paul Richardson, at ASCO at a satellite meeting. And one of the things he was talking about was some stuff he presented at ASCO on melflufen. Can you talk a little bit about what that is? I don't know if I'm guessing you might have had some experience with it and where you see it potentially fitting in.
Yeah, so we were thinking, okay, it's a melphalan-like, and let's try and see how it works. But in fact, the patients are responding with very high responses in extremely heavily treated refractory patients, multiple lines of therapy, and we're still seeing responses. Now, again, melphalan itself is one of the best drugs we've used in myeloma, but for its toxicity and its effects on stem cells, we had shied away from it. So now we have a new compound, potentially very high activity, and we're still trying to dissect the mechanism of activity for that drug. But this could be a well-tolerated drug that can be given after 3-4 lines after being refractory and still getting responses in them. I think what we want to understand better is who are the patients who would benefit from it and are there long-term side effects from giving a melphalan-like agent for many, many years.
What do we know about that? Have you yourself used it?
I've used it in some of my patients, and we had the clinical trial at Dana-Farber Open. It was very well-tolerated. I didn't have side effects in my patients.
So essentially, this is going to fit in as another agent in the relapse refractory setting?
In the heavily pretreated patients, yes.
What about combinations with other agents?
Yeah, so of course, with proteasome inhibitors, because that's important, with IMiDs, because that's another option for our patients, but potentially with daratumumab or the antibodies, I think that would be important to answer the question of using this drug with other agents and bringing it earlier, or in the plasmacytomas, in the extramedullary disease, these are the ones that they're seeing amazing responses in them.
What are some of the other avenues of clinical research, new agents and strategies in myeloma that you're excited about?
I think bispecifics are probably one of the best areas of interest that we have. Some of those agents were starting to see amazing responses. Again, it's very early phase one data. But if these translate into activity, then they will be off-the-shelf immunotherapy and you don't have to use cellular therapy like CAR T. The question will be, do you use one or the other, or how do you define which patient will benefit from one or the other? So I think using immunotherapy in that way will be very interesting in our patients. I think selinexor looks interesting too, again, in heavily pretreated patients. And I think other agents, venetoclax, which comes back now as we think of those patients, 11, 14 patients, and that will be the first time we have precision medicine, venetoclax will be used in those patients with multiple myeloma with 11, 14 translocation. Oral agent, well tolerated.
So selinexor, what is it?
So an XPO1 inhibitor. And again, mechanism of action is still important for us to understand who are the patients who would really benefit from this. But in general, we're seeing it work even in heavily pretreated refractory patients. And potentially, this could be very interesting in salvaging patients, especially when you're trying to bridge them for something else. The original data showed that there was a lot of GI toxicity. Now we're seeing with bortezomib combination, and as the physicians are using it more and more, you have less of that toxicity and you can figure out how to use it. But many of the patients early on were having a lot of nausea and vomiting.
We talked about emerging novel therapies. What about patients with BRAF mutations? Can you talk a little bit about how often this is seen and what we know about BRAF inhibitors in myeloma?
Yeah, and Nupur would have been the best one because she has a clinical trial of BRAF in all cancers, including multiple myeloma. And some cases are responding. The problem is BRAF is not very common. It's 4% of patients with myeloma, so it's not a very common factor. And it's not clonal in all of the patients, so it is a driver mutation, but you may find actually non-BRAF cells also in the same patient. So maybe single agent may not be alone or enough for that patient, and maybe combinations would be useful. However, having said that, the trials that she has ongoing right now are showing very high responses in those patients.
And these are V600E mutations?
Correct, yes.
Do you see other non-V600E mutations also?
Not that I've seen in our data, but again, we can go back and look at the whole exome sequencing data.
And what's the thinking right now? You know, we're seeing more BRAF-MEK combinations in solid tumors. Is that the strategy here also?
We're starting to have a lot of those precision medicine trials. One of those actually was recently opened by the MMRF, where you actually classify patients by their different translocations or mutations, and then you put them in different arms. So either if you're BCL2 or you're 1114, you go into the venetoclax. If you have a BRAF mutation, you go into the BRAF. And if you have MAP kinase mutations like KRAS and RAS, you go into a MAP kinase inhibitor or MEK inhibitor.